I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. And welcome to Minute 36 of Season 6 of Movie on Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is, on the first day of 2024, Happy New Year to everybody. Hope you're all not hungover and that you're ready to just dive in and listen to more about It's a Wonderful Life. So joining me today on, again, the very first episode of 2024, is Richard Kirkham of Kirkham, A Movie a Day, and the Shepherd of the Lambcast. Welcome back to the show, Richard.
I wish I had $1 million.
I know.
I'm glad to be here, Rob. Looking forward to this. This is one of my favorite films, and I've got things to say. I'm not sure I have things to say that apply to all of our scenes, but we'll see how it goes.
No, okay. Well, you know, I give a little bit of leeway here and there, so you can talk about other things too. It's okay. We'll get there. I mean, you and I had a conversation a little over a year ago. We were on a podcast together talking about this movie, so you already know some of my thoughts on it.
Yeah, this was a movie of the month last December, and I believe it was your movie of the month.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. I was anticipating doing this season. So I said, why not? You know, you guys were looking for a movie that was holiday related. And I said, hey, this is a good one. And I was planning on, it was actually later on my list. It was farther down on my list of when I was going to do it. And, you know, after that experience, I was like, okay, I'm going to bump it up. And that's what I did. You know, I annoyed you and a whole bunch of other people that I went too much in depth on the hour and a half podcast that we had, but you know, here I'm able to talk 60-70 hours about it, so it's I'll have a little bit more. So I apologize, even though it's been over a year.
Oh, don't worry about it. It's all good. Just sometimes it's like we're recapping the whole movie, and I'm not sure everybody needed that, but that's just, it's fun to talk about anytime.
That's right. Oh, I learned my lesson when I did for Bridge on the River Kwai a few months later. You know, I needed to keep that one shorter. So, you know, I think I learned my lesson there. And the fact that you let me come back was already a good sign.
You're always welcome on the Lambcast.
Yeah. Okay. So minute 36 begins with George realizing the truth and ends with George telling Harry about the various changes in Bedford Falls. We ended things on Friday with the board coming to a decision and deciding that the only way that they're going to let the Bilbian loan continue is if George Bailey is the executive secretary. And we once again, throughout this, there are numerous points in this movie. This is another one of them where George thinks he's going to be doing something else, but fate has turn the tables on him, and he needs to do the right thing. You know, that's the fatal flaw of George Bailey. You know, he always knows that he needs to do the right thing, even when, you know, he doesn't want to do that.
That's the tough thing. You know, yeah. he knows what's right, and he's going to do it. He can also see that that's going to change what happens in his life.
Correct. Correct.
And the expression on his face at the beginning of this minute is, you know, very indicative of that. It don't have to say anything. It's just, you know, kind of almost a freeze frame on that expression.
That's right. Where he basically just, you see the look on his face is he's basically saying, well, I know what I got to do, even though I don't want to do it. You know, And we're gonna come across that numerous times throughout the course of this movie. Even this week, we'll come across it again. And so basically, the line that was cut off between Friday's episode and today, heard them say, "But George, they'll vote with Potter otherwise." At this point, George realizes that there's nothing that he can do, and pretty quickly there's a fade here, and we're back to the space, time, heaven, whatever you want to call it. Nobody really knows where it is. We got the flashing lights, and we're back with seeing the flashing lights of Clarence and Joseph, and Clarence goes, I know, he didn't go. That's right. Not only that, but he gave his school money to his brother Harry and sent him to college. Harry became a football star, made second team All-American. Yeah, but what happened to George? George got 4 years older, waiting for Harry to come back and take over the building and loan. I mean, I first of all, I like the way that we get this little narration every so often throughout the movie. Between the conversation between Clarence and Joseph, even though it's simplistic. It's a just a simple way for them to give us exposition of like this just line that I just mentioned right now takes
We
us
just
across
covered
four
4 years
years.
of time. Yeah,
That's right.
exactly.
That's right. We jump from 1928 to 1932 just like that. There's really within seconds. You know how they do this. But it's effective because we don't need to see George working at the building alone for 4 years, waiting for Harry to come home. It does make sense just to say it, but this is a great a way of telling us the narrative by having, these characters, Clarence and Joseph, talk about them.
That's right.
And I mean, one of the things that I find it very funny that the thing that Joseph feels is important to mention is the fact that Harry became a football star.
Well, I don't know. When you're looking at somebody's academic achievements, I doubt very much that he'd be talking about his major or, the grade that he got on his final exams. The fact that he became a football star, in 1928, 1929, 1930, those probably seem like important things. And,
No, but I'm talking
second
about the
team All-American,
celestial.
that's important.
But I'm talking about the fact that celestial beings are talking about these things.
Well, remember, the whole point of Joseph telling Clarence all these things is so that Clarence understands, George's life, and that's part of what George's life entails,
Yes,
how he's
for
going to
sure.
be perceived. It's he's George is going to be comparing his life to his to everybody else. Everybody else has gotten the breaks. Everybody else's good things have happened for him. He never resents his brother, but he does see, hey, my brother got to go to college. Hey, my brother got to achieve something great. Hey, my brother, got married and found somebody that he loves. Hey, my brother, as we're about to find out, has maybe a different future than I thought was thinking he was going to have. And so Clarence needs to know what George is going to be facing.
Correct.
And that's why they're talking about it.
Yeah, for sure. Do you know how many sports have All-American teams that are voted upon yearly?
I don't. I would imagine that it's probably all of the major sports have, any that are team-oriented sports. So baseball, basketball, football, probably have those sorts of things. I don't know if the individual sports would have All-Americans or not. Maybe they do.
Okay, so obviously we're talking about this is all college sport,
Yeah.
the All-American teams. Actually, before we get into the actual number, what year do you think they started the whole idea of having All-American teams?
Oh, well, it was probably pretty early. It wouldn't surprise me at all that it was, somewhere in the early 1900s, 1910, 1911, somewhere in there, because that's when these team sports start becoming national interest, that people start paying attention to these kinds of things.
Okay, it's actually 20 years before you mentioned it. In 1889 was the first time
There
that
you
they
go.
had an All-American college football team. Okay, so how many sports do you think there are that have All-American teams?
Oh, I couldn't begin to guess. Like I said, I assume that the major sports do, so that would be four or five, and maybe there are other other sports that I'm just not familiar with. It's probably a lot.
There are 19 sports that have All-American teams.
There you go. What are you going to list? You're going to list the 19 sports?
I'm going to quickly go through the 19. We won't dive into the information, but just to say what they are. In alphabetical order: archery, baseball, basketball, cross-country running, fencing, football, golf, gymnastics, ice hockey, lacrosse, rowing, rugby, sailing, soccer, swimming and diving, tennis, track and field, volleyball, and wrestling.
Yeah, there you go. Like I said, I wasn't sure if they had the individual ones as All-American. So fencing and wrestling and those kinds of things, I didn't know that they would have that, but sure, why not? And all the team ones, it makes sense because you can put together an All-American team from all of the best players in those particular sports. So that, I guess that makes sense. I don't know how you do that with fencing, but whatever.
Okay, so they basically have the NCAA Fencing Championships and then the U.S. Fencing Coaches Association. They annually select athletes for the All-American first team, second team, third team, and honorable mention titles. So, wow, I guess there are a lot of them in fencing.
It's just a ranking, I guess.
Yeah, could be.
Okay.
Yeah. So one of the things that I always find funny is, so here we have these two celestial beings, Joseph and Clarence, that are talking about it. And I mean, obviously, as I mentioned earlier, the exposition that they're giving is for us. It's not for, it's not really that Joseph is teaching Clarence these things, but you'd wonder how Clarence knows what an All-American team is, because he's been dead for 200 years. So who knows?
Yeah, and it wasn't covered in any of Mark Twain's books.
No, not yet. Yes. And then as Joseph is speaking, we actually get to see George and Uncle Billy. They're standing at the train station waiting for somebody. I don't know who it could be. Who could they be waiting for? And there's a sign behind them. Did you notice what the sign says?
I don't remember. I think I did see the sign when I looked back at the scene, but I don't remember what it was. And I didn't remember that it was any of any particular importance. But
oh, it's not necessarily of importance. You got that part wrong there, Richard. It might not be of importance, but it's something we can talk about.
Okay.
So there are three signs in the back. You have the big one that says Bedford Falls, the train stop, so that people can see it. You see this in a lot of movies. You have the sign hanging from above that says the name of which town or where the train is stopping. Then on the wall of the train station, we see a huge sign that says timetable. It looks like it's being written in chalk. You have like all the eastbound trains that are listed there.
Oh yeah, so they got the schedule up on the wall there. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, of course.
So, I'm sure the local conductor or whoever is in charge there posts that every day.
That's right. And then behind George,
there's got to be a Western Union sign, right?
Yes, there is.
Because the train station is where the Western Union telegraph office usually is.
That's right. So what is the Western Union?
Western Union was basically, I think it was also a credit organization originally, but most people are familiar with Western Union as the telegraph company, which was a means of communicating almost instantly in the early stages of electronic communication. Telegraphs, anybody who's seen a Western knows that the telegraph was the main way that they communicated between long distances, and they communicated over a telegraph line. Before telephones, obviously, you didn't have to wait for the Pony Express to show up. You could get a message, almost instantly, but it was all done in code, Morse code, I think, for the most part.
Yeah.
In those days. Later on, of course, it's not Morse code that you get the telegrams, they were printed, I wouldn't say by a typewriter. I'm sure there was some typesetting machine that did them.
Right.
Very famous. There were lots of stories that start with telegrams. I know that you've talked about this already because it was in an earlier minute of the movie, but Mr. Gower, of course, has a telegram that has informed him about the passing of his son.
Yes, and from influenza, which we now know it was the Spanish flu. Because it was 1919, COVID, basically COVID of the 1900s.
telegrams, up until the time the telephone was more ubiquitous, the telegram was the main way of communicating. And then after telephones came along, when you got a telegram, it was usually of some import, something significant or important that needed more attention than you might have given a phone call. Missing a phone call could happen, but it's hard to not get a telegram because they got delivered.
Correct.
And of course, later on, there were singing telegrams, for entertainment purposes.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
That's right.
Since we're talking about Western Union and telegrams, I didn't look it up, but I'll bet you've got it somewhere in your notes. What year was the last year that they sent telegrams?
From what I saw, it was like 1986.
Yeah, it's fairly recent. 1986. I say that fairly recent. That's
40 years. Okay, 40 years, but still. because they changed things. They started using telex services and began to wire money and stuff like that. Exactly. Yeah. Yes, but what year was Western Union formed? Do you know?
And I don't know, but I would guess probably somewhere around 1840, 1850.
1851. Very good.
Good. No, all right.
Yes. So, to have a company that was around for 130 years dealing with this stuff is pretty impressive.
I think Western Union is still around. They just don't do telegrams. They do money transfers still.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I was talking about the fact that they were in charge of, sending telegrams. Whenever I think of telegrams, I always think of the movie The Three Amigos. Where they don't have enough, money for the whole word. Thing. So he starts crossing out the words. he types out the whole thing and then crosses off which words in order to make sure that it fits in with the amount of money that they're willing to pay. And then we start hearing a conversation between George and Uncle Billy. And I love the way that the story basically the conversation picks up in the middle. It isn't the beginning of a conversation. He goes, and there are plenty of jobs around for someone that likes to travel. Look at this here. And he picks up these brochures. And he goes, Venezuela, oil fields, wanted, man with construction experience. Here's the Yukon right here, wanted, man with engineering experience. Then we hear a train horn blow, and he goes, there she blows. You know what the three most exciting sounds in the world are? And Uncle Billy looks at him and goes,
Uncle Billy is food-centric.
That's right. Breakfast is served, lunch is served, dinner. No, no, no. Anchor chains, plane motors, and train whistles. So, it's a pretty strange response even from George, that those are the sounds that he loves to listen to, even though he's probably never heard any of the – well, he's heard the train whistle, but he probably has never heard a plane motor or anchor chains.
Well, remember, George has always had those big expectations, the dreams of traveling the world and doing things ever since he was a little kid. After all, he was – nominated for membership in the National Geographic Society.
Yes, of course.
And so he wanted to travel the world, and so that
and was preparing for his travel, harem.
Yeah, it would seem like they're exactly the kinds of things that you would have in your dreams if you were a kid imagining doing all those things. I had a question for you. It's not necessarily what are the three most exciting sounds in the world, but what are your three favorite sounds in the world?
My three favorite sounds. It's a very interesting question. It's something I never even thought about. Favorite sounds.
Yeah, because over the years, I've had a lot of sounds that I just said, you know what? That's one of my favorite things that I listen for. And let me tell you my three, and then you can think about it a little bit.
Okay.
One of the favorite sounds, of course, is a loved one answering the phone.
Okay.
When you call and somebody that you really care about answers the phone, it's a heartwarming moment. It's something that you appreciate. You're glad that they're there, that everything, you know, that they're capable of answering the phone, that they bothered to do so. I know the world's a different place. People just do texting all the time nowadays and don't really use phones the same way. But look, at the end of the day, there was a phone call for most of my career, and I was always happy to, you know, answer the call or make the call. And
okay.
That was always great.
Oh, wow.
And then, when I was a little kid, we did a lot of traveling. I went with my parents on most of the jobs that they did. They toured around. I think I've told you before that my father was a performer. He was an entertainer.
A magician. And,
yes. And we went to all kinds of places in the West, traveling to do shows at high schools, at colleges, at fairs. We went to all kinds of places. And when you're a little kid and it's been a long day and the day is ending, one of the best sounds in the world is the sound of tires turning on gravel at the end of a long drive.
Oh, wow.
And I always remember that sound, and it was always very rich to me. And one of those things that I just said, oh, that's the, thank God, you know, we're at the end of the day, we're safe and sound. We're coming to a stop and it's ready, you know, we're ready to call an end to the day. And I always liked that sound when I was a kid. And then for years and years, I had two miniature dachshunds that would run up down the hallway whenever I came home. And the sound of miniature dachshunds running down a carpeted hallway became one of my favorite things, because they would just, you know, they were so excited that somebody was home. They would come, and I couldn't even see them. I could just hear the sound of their feet running on the carpet, and it always made me happy. So those are three happy sounds.
Oh,
they're
wow.
Not necessarily the most exciting sounds in the world, but they're three sounds that always made me happy.
Wow, that's great, Richard. Really is. I've never thought about it. You know, I'm gonna have to think about it. Maybe I might have to give you an answer tomorrow. I don't know.
Okay.
It's not something I've ever really thought about. You know, what type of sounds?
Well, I've always heard that smell is maybe the most evocative of our senses, but to me, I think it's been sound.
Really, if you talk about smell, so I know two of my favorite smells. One is the, you know, when you have the first rain, which picks up like all the dust and the leaves and stuff like that. So there's the, you know, the smell of the first rain.
Right.
And I also really enjoy the smell of, you know, after a candle has burnt out.
Oh, okay. You know, that's an interesting one.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's actually a name for the smell that comes up off of the sidewalk when it first rains, as the sidewalk is dry and the rain's hitting it. I think there's a name for that, but I don't know what it is. There's a word for it.
Is that a sniglet?
You know, it's not. I don't think it's a sniglet. I don't think it's something that somebody made up. I think there's actually a scientific word for that odor, but I can't tell you what it is. I didn't look it up. I wasn't thinking about it. I know you'll probably, while you're thinking of your favorite sounds, at some point you'll say, let me see if I can find the answer to that question. Tomorrow, you're going to surprise me. There you go.
Petrichor. A petrichor is the term coined by Australian scientists in 1964 to describe the unique earthly smell associated with rain. It is caused by the water from the rain along with certain compounds like ozone, geosmin, and plant oils and soil.
There you are.
Do you remember that is the name of it, or?
No, I thought it started with a P, but I didn't remember the actual word.
Right. I mean, that's what I found.
No, that sounds absolutely right. I just, like I said, it's not one of those, 20,000 words in my vocabulary.
Well, it's also not something that you're going to necessarily use on a regular basis.
Exactly.
You know, if you want to talk about words, my favorite word in English is defenestrate.
That's a good word.
Are you familiar with the word?
You know what? If I saw it in a sentence, I think I'd understand what was being said. But if you asked me to define it, I probably wouldn't give a very satisfactory answer.
Well, the sentence I would give you is he died by defenestration. But I don't think that wouldn't really help you to understand what the, you know, the defenestration is the act of flying through a window or breaking through a window, something like that.
No, I wouldn't have known that.
Yeah,
That's
so
a cool word.
yes, it really is. I remember, I think I must have been in high school, I had like a word of the day, and that was one of them. And I was like, wow. And here, 30 something years later, I still remember that word. I don't remember most of the 365 words that were on that calendar, but that one I do because, as I said, it's not something that I use on a daily basis unless I'm telling somebody that that's my favorite word.
You
That's
want to hold on to it and keep it in your pocket to be able to drop it at the appropriate time and impress somebody.
yes, of course. Of course. Ooh, in that movie, that character died of defenestration. So
Yeah.
yes. Basically, George, we see that he hasn't lost his thrill for adventure. He's looking forward to listening to anchor chains, plane motors, and train whistles. But I think he's just going to have to settle for train whistles at this point. I don't think there's anything else that's that's going to help him at this point.
I don't think he's going to become a merchant marine.
Probably not. And they continue talking, and they're walking towards where the train is coming in. And back to the fact that Uncle Billy wants, is constantly talking about food. I mean, we see he's sitting there and he's eating peanuts, and then he offers George a peanut. Do you know any other names for peanuts?
There's some slang terms for them, and I don't remember what any of them are.
Okay, so basically, what I found is there are four other names for for a peanut. They're each either called a ground nut,
Goobers.
a goober, very good.
There you go. There's one.
Okay, a pindar, or a monkey nut.
I hadn't heard that one.
Yeah, I didn't either until until I looked them up either. And do you know where peanuts are native of? Like where did they start making peanuts or discover peanuts, I guess?
Where they discovered peanuts, I don't know. I know that peanuts became an industry in the American South because Booker T. Washington finding uses for it. But I couldn't tell you who the first person was who dug a peanut up out of the ground and said, "Hey, let's eat this."
Okay, so peanuts are native to South America.
Okay.
They were originally found in Peru, Bolivia, Argentina, Brazil, that whole area. And eventually, via colonization and the triangle trade, they started making it all over the place. But as you mentioned, the most peanuts that are made these days are made in the US. And it actually was a garden crop during the colonial period. So, yeah.
And you know which U.S. president was originally a peanut farmer, right?
Yes, of course. Of course. That would be Bill Clinton, right? No, I'm just kidding. That would be Jimmy Carter,
That's it.
as of recording, still the oldest living president.
Yes.
And then obviously you have peanut butter that people associate. There are probably more people who use peanut butter in America, at least, than eat peanuts by themselves.
Oh,
When do
I'm
you
sure
think,
that's true, yeah.
right, when do you think peanut butter was developed?
Oh, that's another one of those ones that's probably, 1880, somewhere around there.
Very good. 1890s. Very good. Yeah. And then in 1904, the Beechnut Company started selling peanut butter at the St. Louis World's Fair, and that's where it really started, becoming very popular.
I think the St. Louis World's Fair is one of those places where a lot of things that we think of today as, kind of innovations of a time period were introduced. I think hot dogs, ice cream in a cone. There's something else, maybe cotton candy. I'm not sure. Were innovations that came along during the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis. So meet me in St. Louis, and we'll get some sponge sugar and some ice cream in a cone, and have ourselves a peanut butter sandwich for lunch.
Now, a lot of people talk about the fact that there are a lot of people who are allergic to peanuts. What percentage of the US population do you think is allergic to or have allergic reactions to peanuts? And
It's
we're talking the
probably
whole
a
range, just people, not necessarily just people who have anaphylactic shock, which are some people, who will
They
have
have some kind
different
of
types of
reaction.
allergic reactions to it. Yeah.
Maybe 10%.
0.6%. No,
That's
10,
really
10%.
small.
Yeah, well, it's all relative. I mean, think about how many people are in America, and you take
Yeah, point.
1%, and then it's half of one, a little more than half of 1%. So.
Well, it's really funny because when we were passing out treats on Halloween, one of the questions I asked all the kids, anybody have peanut allergies? Because a lot of the candies that we passed out had peanuts in them. And that's one of those things that you want to be careful about because sometimes kids do have those kinds of issues. But it sounds to me like that's so much more rare that it's not a big deal. I probably didn't need to ask every kid coming to the door.
No, as a parent of two kids who have dairy allergies, I appreciate the fact that you would ask that type of question, because most people don't even think of asking. So there you go. And it's always best to err on the side of caution with these things.
All right.
You don't want some parent banging
Reduce
on
my
your door.
liability.
That's right. Banging on your door. Why the hell did you give my son peanuts? Well, why didn't you ask him if he's allergic to peanuts?
Well, I was going to pass out pints of milk, but I was afraid somebody might be allergic to that.
There you go. You would probably have to buy a lot of pints of milk if that's what you were planning on doing. I think it's easier to give little pieces of candy or peanuts. Here's one peanut for each one. Who knows? Then we get a nice wipe of on the screen. And then we see George and Uncle Billy waiting as people are disembarking from the plane, from the train. We see the porter taking some bags off or whatever, and then we then George basically says, "There's the professor now, old Professor Phi Beta Kappa, All American Bailey." And then the response is, as Harry gets off, he goes, "Why, old George Geographic Explorer Bailey?" And then he goes, "What? No husky dogs? No sled?" And he, "Uncle Billy, you haven't changed a bit." And the response is from George, which is pretty funny, "Nobody ever changes here. You know that." It's a pretty grumpy type of response for him to be saying that, but it makes sense because George always feels trapped.
Yes.
So for him to make to make that type of comment makes a lot of sense.
It does indeed.
And that's all I have for this minute. Did you have anything else you wanted to talk about?
Let me see. Well, I just, it's kind of a funny thing, where he refers to Harry as the professor. I heard that a few times when I was in college by parents or family members, they would refer to me as the professor because I was in college. Obviously later on it would be a more appropriate description of
Yeah,
me, but it
exactly.
was one of those things. I think in those days it was just kind of a acknowledgement of a higher education that somebody's going to school.
And
That's
you
it.
see, and you took it to heart.
Yes, I did.
All right. So every Monday we have a segment called Capra Monday, where my guests will give their top five Frank Capra movies. Start with your number five and work your way up, Richard.
All right. Well, my top five Capra films are first, Mr. Deeds Goes to Town, which I think is pretty solid, very entertaining. It's I'm having one of those old man moments here. I know the guy's name, Gary Cooper. Jiminy crickets. and that's a fun movie with also Walter Brennan is a supporting character there. It's very entertaining, amusing. I did not see the remake with Adam Sandler, but I know that it was pretty successful and people appreciate a good comedy. My number four film is the film that Frank Capra first won his Academy Awards for, It Happened One Night, which is a great romantic comedy with Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. And it's, if people haven't seen that film, I think they would really enjoy it. It's very entertaining, and it is funny and romantic. It's famously responsible for the decline in t-shirt sales at one point, because there's a scene in the movie where Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert share a hotel room, and he puts up the Walls of Jericho and he's not wearing an undershirt, and suddenly, you know, those became passé. Holy criminy, Clark Gable's not wearing an undershirt, why do we need to?
That's right. And that movie also spawned the idea of Bugs Bunny eating a carrot.
Yep. I remember that. Clark Gable was chomping on the carrot. I'm not sure he said, "What's up, Doc?" But he might have.
I don't think he said it, but it was the pose.
And then Meet John Doe would be my third. I like kind of the political aspect of that. I think that's pretty interesting. I'm trying to remember the actor who's the villain in that piece. He's so good in so many things, and it's I'm blanking out on it right now. That's a good film, and it's another one. It's very hopeful, very hopeful. By the way, I did exclude It's a Wonderful Life from my choice. I think we had this conversation.
Why would you do that?
Because we're already talking about It's a Wonderful Life. I was going to say, I think we had this conversation three or four projects ago when we talked about Die Hard, you know?
And, right.
And I think I did the same thing, and you were surprised that I would do that. And I just said, well, because we're already talking about that, so
right.
I wanted to talk about other films.
Okay, I think you're referring to Edward Arnold.
Yes, that's who I'm talking about. Thank you very much. And he's got those pince-nez glasses that he wears during the film. And he just, I mean, he doesn't have a mustache to twirl, but he's got a great voice that is all villainy and oily.
Mm-hmm.
And then number two is Arsenic and Old Lace, which is just hysterical. It's got Raymond Massey in it playing basically Boris Karloff, you know, so it's a funny bit there. Peter Lorre is in the film. And Cary Grant is the star. And people who aren't familiar with it, Cary Grant's aunts are, they're murdering people and putting them in the basement. But they're not malicious murderers. They believe they are, you know, it's like euthanasia. You know, it's one of those strange sorts of things that they use to justify it. And then my favorite outside of It's a Wonderful Life is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is a political film and has Claude Rains in it, who's one of my favorite character actors from the period. It's just and the same sort of thing. There's a lot of emotional wallop to it. It's very patriotic, and I appreciate the Capra patriotism. I think that's a good thing, not a bad thing.
Yeah, of course. That makes sense. All right, great. So you want to tell everyone where they can find Richard Kirkham?
Well, you could locate me at my blog site, which is Kirkham A Movie A Day. I have two sites. There's a blogger page that's kirkhamclass.blogspot.com, but there's also a WordPress page, same content basically, at kirkhamamovieaday.com. Everything's better organized on the Blogspot page, and I have additional pages that link to other projects there. And of course, on a weekly basis, you can find me on the Lamcast, which is the official podcast of the Large Association of Movie Blogs, which I hope a lot of people will be interested in joining or investigating. And we do a weekly podcast on a variety of subjects. Most months we have a movie of the month. We cover one or two new films that are released. We have special franchise kinds of shows and lookbacks, and we have draft shows, and we talk about actors and actresses in particular. And we, like I said, we get a variety of guests each week who are bloggers, writers, podcasters, who all have something that they want to say about a movie, and they participate in the process. And you, of course, have been a guest on many times, and we're looking forward to hearing from you again.
Can't wait for that. Can't wait for that. All right. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, and you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.